Okay, so welcome back again. we're going to continue with still a little bit more to do on the factor of right effort on the path. And yesterday we were looking at these five themes for reflection, which are a lot to do with impermanence. And I'm going to look at another sutta which also has to do with the idea of impermanence, but in a slightly kind of different scale, a different way of looking at it. The sutta today is just a bit more of a kind of fun sutta. It's a slightly bit different from ordinary suttas. It's a bit more mythological, perhaps, or perhaps not. This is one of the things we want to have a look at when we do this one. But I like the sutta because it is precisely because it is a bit different from the ordinary way of teaching these things. This sutta is called the Seven Sons, from the Anguttara Nikaya 7, we shall see what happens as we go through this one here. So, okay. So, on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vesali in Ambapali's grove, and there the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, those bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this. So this is Vesali, which is one of the great cities in India at that time, the capital of the Vajjayan Republic, and Ambapali's grove. This was Ambapali, very famous courtesan at that time, and she was very wealthy, and she donated this mango grove to the Sangat, and with the Buddha at its head, and that's where they were staying in her grove. And she later on became a bhikkhuni, and she is supposed to become an arahant according to the suttas. So it's quite an inspiring story. And so now they're staying there, and this is what happens on this occasion. Bhikkhus, conditioned phenomena are impermanent. Conditioned phenomena are unstable. Conditioned phenomena are unreliable. It is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So, conditioned phenomena, what exactly is a conditioned phenomena? The Pali word is sankhara, the idea here is that conditioned phenomena is everything within our experience. From the Buddhist point of view, the world is basically the world of experience. So whatever we experience, that is really considered the world. So everything that comes within the scope of our experience is what is called conditioned phenomena. Because everything we experience, always changing, always becoming otherwise, etc. So, and all of these, everything that comes within experience is impermanent. It is unstable. It is unreliable. And it's nice sometimes to see these alternative words for idea of anicca. Anicca is impermanent here. And to see these other words that are kind of synonyms for that. Because sometimes a word like impermanent, at least for me, it doesn't really grab me very much. Emotionally, it doesn't really mean very much. I kind of just skip over it. But something like unreliable to me is more kind of has a more powerful effect sometimes. So it's good to sometimes see synonyms and different ways of translating and different ways the words are used, because it broadens out your understanding of what is meant by these things. So impermanent, right? Unreliable, unstable, subject to change. These are the kind of things here. The word, the Pali word behind unreliable is anasasaka. And asasaka is derived from the word to breathe. Yeah, so it means like breathing easily, being at ease. When you breathe easily, you relax. If you get tense, your breath kind of becomes short and it's not really relaxed anymore. So the idea here is you cannot breathe easily. That's what it means, quite literally. Anasasaka. You cannot breathe easily. You can't relax. You can't really just rely on anything. That's why it's unreliable, uncertain. So this is the problem with these things. You're always on your... impermanence is problematic. The world is inherently unreliable and uncertain. All conditioned phenomena, everything within your experience. That is what the Buddha is saying here. So this sutta then is an example of how to look at the world as everything being unreliable. And it's slightly different from from usual. It is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena. The word for disenchanted is nibbida. And nibbida is a bit like, the meaning of this word is almost a bit like being averse. Yeah, you are averse to something, you are repelled by something. And the idea, of course, here is that when you see that something is inherently unreliable, your mind moves away from that. You're no longer interested in that. You become repelled by it. Your mind is pushed away. Just like the simile of the hot plate I mentioned the other day. Your mind, just like the hand, automatically withdraws from that hot plate when you put your hand there by accident. In the same way, the mind automatically withdraws from samsara when you see that everything is unreliable. It means that everything really, there's an underlying suffering there with everything, because nothing can really be held on to. Everything is unreliable. So your mind, oh, don't want to see it anymore. You're going to move away. It's not the kind of aversion which is, has anything to do with anger or anything like that, or ill will. It's just a natural aversion when you see something which is very unpleasant and you want to look a different direction. This is what is meant by this. Your mind just turns away from that, turns in a different to a different place. That's what it really means. So just like you might see something in the human realm which is very unpleasant, something that you hard to bear, somebody suffering a lot, and you kind of can't really keep your eyes on it, it's just too much to bear. It doesn't mean that you are angry or upset, it just means that, oh, can't see it, it's just too much. And this is a similar kind of feeling here. But in this case, it's the whole of samsara, the whole of existence that you're turning away from. And of course, when you do that, when you turn away from those phenomena, you become dispassionate. You're no longer interested. Craving comes to a halt. That's what that really means. So you no longer desire those things. Yeah, when you kind of you move away, and then desire kind of gets at least temporarily eliminated, and then eventually you are liberated from them. And liberation from them is when craving and desire gets permanently eliminated, and you have no more attachment or no more craving for any of this at all. So this is what the point of this is, right? To be liberated from all of these things, because you see their true nature. And this is like the beginning of that, just learning to reflect on these things in the right way and eventually get there by insight as well. So it's quite it's a nice way of seeing all phenomena as impermanent. Before we were just looking at death and old age, which is like limited in scope, but here we're expanding it out to include absolutely everything here. So this is why this is quite interesting here. Then we have this little paragraph in between here, which is a bit curious, and I will read it out because and then discuss it briefly here. Bhikkhus, Sineru, the king of mountains, is 84,000 yojanas in length, 84,000 yojanas in width. It is submerged 84,000 yojanas in the great ocean and rises up 84,000 yojanas above the great ocean. Now, a yojana is a measure of distance in ancient India. It means something like a yoke length or something like that. And it apparently is supposed to be how far a pair of oxen can draw a cart in one day or something like that. That's kind of roughly what it's supposed to mean. And it is usually said to be about maybe 13, 14, 15 kilometers, something like that. So if you make your calculation there, you find that these mountains are rather enormous. We're talking about a million kilometer in length, a million kilometer wide, etc. So the Earth, I think, as far as I know, the Earth is about 12,000 kilometers in diameter. So that gives you, this is just vastly, vastly larger than the whole Earth. So what is this Sineru, king of mountains? If it is so enormous, what does it actually refer to? And in later Buddhism, what it refers to a mythological mountain at the center of the universe. And not at the center of the visible universe, but at the center of the universe in terms of the higher realms. Yeah, like the Tavatimsa Loka, the gods of the 33. And it is a mythological mountain existing in these realms. And it isn't really talked about in early Buddhism at all. The Buddha doesn't talk about this mountain. It occurs here, but it occurs almost nowhere else in the suttas, and not really clearly defined. So I personally regard that just as mythology. And maybe there is an equivalent in other realms, who knows? But it is essentially mythological from the Buddhist, I would say, from a kind of EBT, early Buddhist text point of view, it is mythological. What then is this paragraph doing there? How come this paragraph is there? And this is where it is always interesting to compare the suttas in the Pali with the suttas in parallel versions in the Chinese. There are 4 or 5 parallels to this particular sutta. And I did look up this very quickly this morning. This is one of the things I enjoy about the suttas, to look them up a little bit before I talk about them, just to have some, because it broadens my understanding of these teachings as well. And one of these parallel suttas is found in the Madhyama Agama, the Chinese parallel to the Majjhima Nikaya. And in there, that particular passage is not there. It's missing. It just goes straight from being liberated from them, and it goes to that point, sub-point one. That whole, those 3 lines are actually missing in the Chinese version. And if you look at the part, if you look at the translation here, it looks a little bit inserted, doesn't it? It talks about enough to be liberated from them, and then it starts with the sutta, there comes a time, and kind of this weird scenario, King of Mountains, kind of put in the middle there without any real explanation, any real reason. It does look, it could very well have been inserted when you look at it in that way. So I think that is probably what has happened. It's probably just the later mythology that has kind of been added in there. And the reason why it has been added in there is because Sineru is mentioned further down in the sutta. But further down, it is not actually given any particular reference. Further down is just a name. And then, it could mean anything. Maybe it is a reference to the Himalaya mountains. Who knows what it is? But further down, it is a very it doesn't have any specific reference. So this is how sometimes, again, we have to be a little bit on the lookout with the suttas. Sometimes we have later material that intrudes into the suttas. And the reason why that happens sometimes is because in the ancient times when they recited the suttas orally, often they would recite the commentaries on the suttas in parallel with the suttas. And when the commentary is recited in parallel or just after or whatever, then, of course, sometimes that commentarial material, you will lose track of what's going on and it will become part of the sutta. And this is one of the things that people like Venerable Anāyo has documented, that this actually is happening. You can see that. You see the Pali commentaries sometimes intrude into the Chinese suttas. And sometimes it's the other way around. And we can deduce that this is what is happening on that basis. So that seems to be what's going on here. Otherwise, it's really hard to make any sense of this particular passage. So that's just a little bit about Buddhist mythology and how that later on becomes much more important. And when you start to read the later text after the Buddha, things tend to get more mythological, more legends, more kind of stuff which you're not really sure exactly how to interpret it. Anyway, so that is that one. That is about that. So let us continue with the sutta. And the Buddha says, there comes a time, bhikkhus, when rain does not fall for many years, for many hundreds of years, for many thousands of years, for many hundreds of thousands of years. When the rain does not fall, seed life and vegetation, medicinal plant, grasses and giant trees of the forest, wither and dry up and no longer exist. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. It is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So here the Buddha is almost like peering into the future, right? There will come a time when for many hundreds of thousands of years there is no rain, and of course then the vegetation starts to kind of wither away and die completely, and all vegetation is gone, and it's not quite the same to live on this planet when there is no vegetation. So you can see why this is kind of drives home the point of the danger of impermanence, right? The suffering, because you can't really live on a planet when there is no vegetation there. And of course, if you look at the future history of the planet Earth, this is exactly what's going to happen, right? Eventually, things will get too hot, and all the rain will stop, and all the plants will die. This is exactly what the future has in hold for us. So the Buddha, what he says here, is obviously quite right. I will talk later on about how the Buddha, why it is the Buddha could say such things, what actually is going on here, because that is also, I think, quite interesting here. Let us just go through the cases first of all. Number two, there comes a time when after a long time, a second sun appears. With the appearance of the second sun, the small rivers, the lakes, and lakes dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. It is enough to become disenchanted, repelled by all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So here we have this idea of a second sun, and my interpretation of that is not that it actually is another sun. My interpretation is that it is a second stage of the first sun, and that's how I would read this. So the sun reaches another stage where it is even larger, right, warmer, even more powerful. And then, of course, it has an even more detrimental effect on what is happening on the planet. Number three, there comes a time when after a long time, a third sun or a third stage of the sun appears. With the appearance of the third stage of the sun, the great rivers, the Ganges, the Yamuna, the Achiravati, the Sarabu, the Mahi, dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, etc. It is enough to be liberated from them. There comes a time when after a long time the fourth stage of the sun appears. With the fourth stage of the sun, the great lakes, from which those great rivers originated, the Anuttata, the Sihapapata, the Ratthakara, the Kannamunda, the Kunala, the Chadanta, and the Mandakini, dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. It is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. There comes a time when after a long time the fifth stage of the sun appears. With the appearance of the fifth stage of the sun, the waters in the great ocean sink or recede by 100 yojanas, 200 yojanas, 300 yojanas, up to 700 yojanas. The water left in the great ocean stands at the height of 7 palm trees, at the hand of 6 palm trees, 5 palm trees, 4, 3, 2, a mere palm tree. The water left in the great ocean stands at the height of 7 fathoms, 6 fathoms, 5, 4, 3, to a single fathom, half a fathom, up to the waist, up to the knees, up to the ankles. You see here the Buddha is really kind of is driving home the point, right? And this kind of how things will slowly go down. And sometimes I think part of the reason why you drag it out like that, because you want the message to sink home. And sometimes it takes a while for the message to really kind of sink in, what actually is going on. So you drag it out to kind of make it very clear what's happening here. Just as in the autumn, when thick drops of rain are pouring down, the waters stand in the hoof prints of cattle here and there, so the water left in the great ocean will stand here and there in pools the size of hoof prints of cattle. With the appearance of the fifth stage of the sun, the water left in the great ocean is not enough even to reach the joints of one's fingers. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. It is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So this passage here, basically all about the ocean drying up, the last water of the planet is disappearing completely. And one of the strange little things here, I don't know if you noticed that as I was reading through that, but one of the strange things here, everything revolves around the number 7. Did you see that? 700 yojanas, the 7 palm trees, right? The 7 fathoms, everything revolves around the number 7. And this is one of the things that you see in the suttas. It's almost as if the number 7 has some kind of special significance almost. And I'm not sure what that is. But in mythology apparent, and the word 7 has a special kind of significance in mythology. And I guess in ancient society, like most ancient societies, mythology and legends were kind of part of how that society worked. Right? In our modern society, we have like the 7-day week, and that is kind of a similar kind of thing as well. So it is based around these kind of strange numbers. And sometimes where they come from these ancient cultures where these things have existed for a long time as part of the mythology of those cultures. And often they are just used in this way, almost as a matter of course, because that's how society works. And that is maybe where these things come from, these kind of weird things. It's also, you can find this in other places in the suttas as well. You find it in the Satipatthana Sutta, for example. And at the end of the Satipatthana Sutta, it says if you practice the Satipatthana for 7 years, then you will become enlightened or an anagami. Then it goes from 7 years down to 1 year. And then it goes from 1 year to 7 months. Yeah, it doesn't go 11 months, 10, it goes to 7 months. And it goes from 7 down to 1 month, and then it goes to 7 days. So the similar kind of idea again, even in a sutta like the Satipatthana Sutta, which is of course one of the important suttas on meditation practice, even there you find this kind of usage of the number 7 kind of appearing. So it, I think it's just something part of the ancient Indian culture, maybe the world culture in fact, that you find it in all civilizations around the world. So just a small little point. I don't know, I find these things kind of interesting because you wonder why it's there, right? It kind of looks slightly strange when you see it. And it's nice to have a kind of an explanation for these things because when you don't understand something, then it is always a bit kind of slightly unsettling. You wonder what's going on. Okay, the next one. There comes a time when after a long time, the 6th stage of the sun appears. With the appearance of the 6th stage of the sun, this great earth and Sineru, there is Sineru again, the king of mountains, smoke, fume and smolder, just as a potter's fire, when kindled, first smokes, fumes and smolders, so with the appearance of the 6th stage of the sun, this great earth and Sineru, the king of mountains, smoke, fume and smolder. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. It is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So here, it is now the earth is being kindled, a bit like the potter's fire here. So it's starting to smoke, just like a potter's fire here. And of course, what you see here, as we are progressing here, you're seeing pretty much exactly the same as we know today in modern cosmology, what will happen to the Earth eventually. This is exactly what is going to happen in the future, way down the line, of course, a few billion years from now or something. But still, we know that this is exactly the future that is in store for the planet. So let's go to the last stage. There comes a time when after a long time, a 7th sun, or the 7th stage of the sun, here you are, number 7 again, right? With the appearance of the 7th stage of the sun, this great earth and Sineru, the king of mountains, bursts into flames, blaze up brightly, and become one mass of flame. as the great earth and Sinéru are blazing and burning, the flame cast up by the wind rises even to the Brahma world. As Sinéru is blazing and burning, as it is undergoing destruction and being overcome by a great mass of heat, mountain peaks of 100 yojanas disintegrate, mountain peaks of 200, 300, 400, 500 yojanas disintegrate. When this great earth and Sinéru, the king of mountains, are blazing and burning, neither ashes nor soot are seen. Just as when ghee or oil are blazing and burning, neither ashes nor soot are seen, so it is when this great earth and Sinéru, the king of mountains, are blazing and burning. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable, it is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So here you have the Buddha basically saying that in the future the earth is going to burn up. Yeah, and he's doing this not because he's kind of predicting the future or because he wants to kind of show off his powers or anything like that, but he's using it as a lesson in impermanence. Can you imagine it would have had a very powerful effect on people at that time because they had no clue about these things. There was no astronomy as we have it today. There was no knowledge about these things. So the Buddha is here kind of telling them what is going to happen, how the earth is going to disintegrate in the future. And of course, now we know that this is exactly what, this is the reality of things. We know that the sun is going to expand in stages, or gradually, if you like. And eventually, it will engulf the whole earth. Eventually, there's still some, apparently, a little bit of discussion whether the earth will burn up completely or whether there will be a remnant of the earth. I think the astronomers aren't 100% sure of these things yet. Essentially, it is exactly the same story, what we know from modern cosmology, which is very interesting, right? It's kind of fascinating, and it makes you wonder, what is going on here? I talked about this a couple of years ago at the Maloka Center, because I always found this sutta very kind of almost mind-blowing. How on earth, what is going on here? Is it maybe we are interpreting the text in kind of a way which fits with modern ideas, or maybe there is some kind of corruption to the text, that these ideas have got in there somehow. But corruption to the text is really impossible, because this modern ideas of cosmology only happened over the past century or so. Right, but these texts, they have existed in different languages, and they separated centuries, millennia ago, they went their different ways, and they exist in both texts to the present day. So these are common ideas that go back to the very early days of Buddhism. So it's not something that has been added there, that's very obvious. What about the idea that we are just interpreting it in a wish, it's like wishful thinking, and we're reading things into it which isn't actually there? But not really, because the Pali, the text, is actually very simple. It's fairly obvious what is going on. The earth is burning up. The sun is becoming hotter. There isn't really much doubt about that. The only thing that there could be doubt about is whether there is seven suns or the seven stages. That is a bit unclear. But apart from that, the general idea of more heat and the earth burning up, it is there. Yeah, there isn't really any scope for interpreting this in the wrong way. So it seems like the Buddha was actually seeing, he was predicting what was going to happen to the earth in the future. So how is that possible? How can the earth predict, how can the Buddha predict the future in this way? And of course, the most likely way, from my point of view, is that he would have remembered the past. And by remembering the past, he would see that this is the nature of suns, of stars. It is to expand and eventually engulf the planets that go around them. So his knowledge was based on the recollection of the past, and by understanding the past, he could then deduce that this is going to happen in the future as well. That to me is the only really possible way how the Buddha would have known about these things. So then, the strange thing, when I read a sutta like this, I when I first read it, I just didn't really know what to make of it. I kind of just shrugged my shoulders and kind of read on to the next sutta, because you don't really, okay. But after a while, it kind of sinks in that there's something actually quite remarkable going on here. There is no real explanation for this, apart from the Buddha having some special insight into the nature of reality. And the way he would have had to remember the past would have been to recall his past lives. Yeah, that is the only way you would be able to know the past in that way. This is the standard way you see in the suttas. So to me, at the end of all of that, it is what this shows us in a way, by comparing this to modern astronomy and that kind of thing, it actually points to the Buddha having remembered his past lives. That is what it does to me. It is actually just a piece of evidence that the Buddha recalled his past lives. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to know this. So that is how that is my conclusion from all of that, that the Buddha actually was looking into the past and then deducing the future on that basis. And then he tells the monks about this. Well, this is what it's like, right? There wasn't any theory about this at that time in India. There was nobody else. If you look at some of the other ancient Hindu scriptures, they have nothing like this. This is kind of completely unique, as far as I know, to the Buddhist scriptures at that time. So this is one of those interesting things. And the Buddha then, he doesn't use this to kind of make philosophical claims about the nature of the universe. He just used it simply to point out the impermanence of all phenomena. He used it in a practical way here. And what is interesting about the suttas is that they contain a little bit of information, not only here, but in other places as well. They contain information that is really hard to understand how the Buddha could have known. Information that fits with kind of modern astronomy, modern cosmology, and how we look at the cosmos in the present day. And again, it is some of that stuff is really weird, because you recognize that it is only just now that we are beginning to understand these truths 2,500 years later. And one of those things that the Buddha talks about in the suttas, I just enjoy this kind of stuff. Please excuse me for kind of getting a bit sidetracked with these things, but one of the things that the Buddha talks about, he talks about like the Jambudipa. Jambudipa is like a name for India at that time. And then he talks about the other continents lying around India. And that is like the planet Earth. Yeah? So he talks about that, the planet Earth and the countries around it. They didn't really know much about the countries around India. They weren't very clued in about what the world was like. So they had kind of mythological names, but essentially talking about the Earth. And then the Buddha talks about the sun and the moon, right? That was the known kind of universe at that time, because these things revolved around each other. And that was like one entity, and that was called a world system. And that world system had human beings, it had various gods and all that kind of stuff. That was part of that one world system. But then the Buddha says, there isn't just one world system like this, with a sun, with a moon, with an earth. There is a 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000, 1,000 to the third power, if you like, world systems out there, in the existing. Yeah. So the Buddha was basically saying that the solar system that we have here is not a single one. There are masses of these solar, billions of these solar systems out there. And it would have been absolutely mind-boggling. How could he know that? How could the Buddha have known about these things, right? Only in the very last couple of decades have we discovered that all this stuff. First of all, we had to discover that all those little light dots in the sky actually are stars. That is a fairly recent discovery. If you go back to Europe to the Middle Ages, the sky was just considered to be these lights in the kind of 100 kilometers up, and there was like a light in the, like a ceiling light here, right? Similar kind of thing here. Those were the stars up until about the, you had the revolution with Galileo and all that kind of stuff. And then they started to realize, actually, it's much larger than that. So then, first of all, they discovered the stars, but only very recently have we discovered that there are planets going around those stars. But the Buddha went further. He said that actually not only that, but there are living beings there as well. So from the suttas, you can predict that down the track, we are going to discover those living beings on those planets, right? Out there in the in the solar, in the galaxy somewhere here. So again, it's kind of, it's absolutely mind-blowing. Indian society 2,500 years ago, very simple technologically wise compared to what we are now. And yet the Buddha had an understanding that was kind of 2,500 years ahead of his time. And again, obviously had to do with his recollection of past lives, his understanding of the contraction and expansion of the universe, which is another thing that the Buddha seems to have known about, how the universe goes through vast periods of contraction and expansion. Again, he would have known that through his understanding and recollection of the past. Yeah, so this is, so sometimes you wonder, you know, how is it possible for a human being at that time to know all of these things? But it's very clear from the suttas that Buddha actually knew about these things. And that is, I don't know, to me anyway, it is kind of mind-blowing that is even possible. But that seems to be what had happened at that time. So this man, imagine, he's sitting under this tree, right, in the forest somewhere. But what's going on inside his mind is kind of astonishing here. So that is what we are seeing here. So, but again, the idea here is not so much to kind of just talk about these things for the sake of talking about them, but to give a feeling of impermanence. And once you understand that, of course, that the whole universe, the whole earth, everything that you rely on in this life is so impermanent, of course, then you can see why that this leads to this feeling of how everything is so unreliable. And when everything is seen as so unreliable and unstable and uncertain, that is when that sense of being repelled by it kind of kicks in. And you get repelled, and eventually you get liberated by the destruction of craving and desire itself. And this is really the bottom line with the idea of impermanence, is this understanding that there is nowhere to stand. There is nothing to hold on to. There's nothing to latch on to, whether it is the phenomenal world or even whether it is ideas sometimes. Everything is always subject to change. Everything is moving around. As soon as you try to put your foot down there, foot down somewhere, somebody comes and pulls out the carpet under your feet, and you stumble and you fall over because you have attached, you have tried to stand on a place where actually the earth was constantly shaking and moving. It's like a constant earthquake, always making you unstable. And this is that understanding of impermanence, when you know there's nothing to hold on to in the world. And you know that every time you hold on to something which is unstable, you are asking for suffering. You're saying, please allow me to suffer. That's what you're saying every time you hold on. And yet, we have to hold on. This is kind of the paradox of things. We have to hold on. And the reason we have to hold on is because of our sense of self. This is one of the functions of a sense of self, is to grasp onto things and hold on to things. Because when you have a sense of self, the only way that sense of self can exist is through its attributes. Basically its attributes. It has to kind of have certain attributes. And as soon as you have attributes, then you identify with those because that is yourself. You are already in trouble because those very attributes are going to be impermanent. And because they are impermanent and because you're attaching to that, you're going to suffer as a consequence. So whenever there is a sense of self, there always has to be attachment, because the sense of self requires identity. It requires something to fill it in, to make it into something that actually exists for us. And that is why, as long as you have a sense of self, you have to suffer as a consequence. Because the grasping, the attachment, the holding on to things is a consequence of the sense of self. And that is why on the Buddhist path, the first insight, the real insight that we have when you see the Dhamma fully, is the insight into non-self. Because then, at that point, only then is it possible to detach from everything and let go of everything. Because then you have seen the illusion. You've seen that you were just blinded all along. And when you see that, you no longer have to attach. You no longer have to hold on. And then you can let go of all these impermanent phenomena. And then, of course, that is why you are liberated from suffering. You can only be liberated from suffering by seeing through the delusion of a self. So this is how it works, right? And this is why these things have to happen in the right way and in the right process and the right procedure. Yeah? And then you are on the kind of the right track. Yeah? So everything is always unstable. Everything is unreliable. It's like a carpet being pulled out from under your feet at any time. You stumble, you fall over because you were standing in the wrong place, attaching to the wrong thing. And this is what the Buddha is pointing out here, but he's pointing it out in different ways. Sometimes using maranasati, recollection of death. Sometimes using these big picture things, right? The whole cosmos is kind of disintegrating. And there are other ways too that he talks about impermanence in the suttas. So there you are. So this is an important part of how we reflect on these things. And then the Buddha says at the very end here, which is also kind of drives home the point that I've been trying to talk about. Because who except those who have seen the truth would think or believe this great earth and Sineru, the king of mountains, will burn up, be destroyed, and will no longer exist. Yeah, so here he's telling the monks, well, you know, the only reason why you believe this is because you have faith in me, you have confidence in what I'm saying. There is no other way that you will be able to know this. How could anyone believe this except by seeing it for themselves? That is what he's saying there. So he realizes, the Buddha realizes, this goes against all beliefs that exist in India at the time. And he's adding something that only a person with confidence and faith will accept. Except when you come 2,500 years down the track, then we know that the Buddha actually was spot on. So sometimes you can see faith is well placed. In this case, it would have been very, very well placed indeed. So there you are. This is this in my opinion, it's a very interesting sutta. It is different from what the normal suttas that I like to look at, but interesting because it is quite different. One of the suttas that I often also like to read out on these retreats is one of those suttas is the Ratapala Sutta. In the Ratapala Sutta, there are four summaries of the Dhamma at the end of that sutta. It is Ratapala, he's the clansman, he's a kind of one a wealthy man who has gone forth from the homeless life and becomes an arahant. And then he comes back to visit his parents. And after visiting his parents, it's a nice story about visiting his parents, but after that he goes to see this king. And when he sees this king is kind of amazed. He says, well, you are still a young man. You are still kind of strong, sturdy. You don't have any ill health. You come from a wealthy family, the kind of the almost the pinnacle of society and all these kind of things. And yet you have gone forth. How come? What's going on? Why did you go forth? And then Ratapala explains to this king why he went forth. What were the teachings that the Buddha actually gave him so as to go forth? And one of the things that he says in there, he says that there is no protector and there is no shelter in the world. There's no Isara. Isara means like lord or protector or god. There is no such thing. Yeah, there's nobody to protect you. You just die and then you have pass on according to your own actions. And there's nobody there to kind of look after you. And this is one of the places in the suttas where the Buddha actually makes this point very specifically, that there is no kind of, in the end, there is no one to pray to. There is no one to ask favors from. You have full responsibility for your life. It comes back to you. You have to take charge of your life. And this is similar to this idea we're looking at here of impermanence, right? The idea that impermanence is nothing to hold on to in this world. There is no God, there is nothing there which is kind of going to save you. The only person who can look after you is yourself. You have to take responsibility for your own life. And sometimes this is very scary for people to take full responsibility for yourself. You feel that you haven't really got the insight. You feel you haven't got the understanding. You feel so small, right? This cosmos, this world seems so such a scary place. It's very nice to have like a mother or the father in the sky who kind of looks after you. Yeah, okay, just relax. I will look after you in the end. It's a very soothing kind of thing. You can see why, at least that is one reason, why this would be very attractive to people. And this is one of the challenges with the Buddhist teachings, one of the few religions where there is no such final God or final thing where that looks after you, but where you have full responsibility for yourself. So initially, it's scary. But then when you think about it, actually, it is also very liberating, the fact that we are responsible for ourselves. Because if there is a kind of mother or father in the sky, you don't really know if they are 100% benevolent. What if they are responsible for the not 100% benevolent? Or maybe, you know, sometimes you hear about these Hindu gods. Not all of those Hindu gods are all that nice. Have you seen Kali? Kali, for example, one of the famous Hindu gods with kind of big fangs. This is a female god, big fangs, and then the kind of blood dripping off, right? It looks really, really scary. And then they go out and they pray to these gods afterwards. I would have been scared to pray to a god like that. See, it's like, you know, go and kill my enemies and that kind of stuff, that kind of god. So actually, you know, if you rely on some kind of external force that you don't really know anything about, and if you see how the world works, some people say, oh, God created this world. If you look at how this world is, what kind of God is it that would have created this world? It's a fair kind of question, right? So all of these things brings a degree of uncertainty in there. So it's actually, in the end, it's very liberating and very empowering that we are able to take full responsibility for our own lives. It empowers you and it liberates you. Scary to begin with, but then you feel empowered afterwards, because now it is up to you to do what is right. And this is the good thing about that. So, even though everything is impermanent, even though the world is kind of shaky, unreliable, uncertain, it is within our power to do something about this. And precisely, because there is no creator God, if there was a creator God, then it would have been problematic, because certain things would have been fixed, certain laws of nature, certain things you couldn't change anything with. You would have a permanent soul, right? And if that soul had certain characteristics, nothing you can do about that. But actually, we can change things, and we can alter things, and we can overcome these problems precisely because everything is impermanent. And they are not just impermanent, but they are impermanent in a way that they are upheld by causes and conditions. So if you act on those causes and conditions, then things will change accordingly. And that's why there is this path, and why there is this practice, and why eventually there is liberation from all of these things. So that is just a little bit more about impermanence for you. So just to draw things out a little bit. And now I have really finished that part of the path which is about right effort, how to use our minds wisely, and how to think about things in a way whereby we reduce our defilements and we move towards a more wholesome state of mind. And of course, once we get to this particular point where the defilements in the mind have been reduced to a minimum, that is where mindfulness has a possibility to arise. As long as the defilements are very strong, it's very hard to be really mindful, because the mind is then driven by desires into the future and driven by ill will often into the past. So these defilements often make it very almost impossible to be really mindful. So once right effort has done its work and we have been able to reduce those defilements a fair amount, then mindfulness arises. And when mindfulness arises, it means you are in the present moment. You have a degree of clarity as well about what is going on. And that is where meditation becomes possible. And that is why right effort moves on to samma sati, satipatthana, because satipatthana can really only happen once the defilements have been reduced to a certain extent. You can see here how the path works, right? You start off with a degree of right view at the beginning. The Buddha says, this is the way the world is. And you say, yeah, okay, kind of makes sense. And that makes you change your aim, right, and purpose in life. And then when you change your aim and purpose, you start off by practicing that path which comes with that aim and purpose, and you start off by purifying yourself by body and speech. Then, when that is purified sufficiently, then you also do the purification of the mind, and that's what we've been talking about now, right effort. And then when the mind reaches a certain degree of purification, mindfulness becomes strong enough, then you can do the real meditation practice, which is called Satipatthana. And the purpose of that, we will have a look at that in a little bit this afternoon, the purpose there is to remove the final little micro defilements in the mind, things that you're not even aware of as defilements, and remove that, collect the mind together, and then make it ready for samadhi, which is the last factor of the path. This is how the path flows forward, takes you from the beginning all the way to the end. Okay, so that is all for now, so we'll see you again at 3 o'clock this afternoon.